content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello again, this is Randall Rickman from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Our cover story for this edition: The Drone Age, a Special Report. We go right to the beginning of this issue, and that brings us to the page called For the Record, a one-page collection of tiny news items, each one illustrated by a line drawing, a quotation in bold, or a combination of the two. In the upper right corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Donald Trump, U.S. President, regarding the on-again, off-again nature of a planned summit with North Korea. The quotation from President Donald Trump, quote, "Everybody plays games," unquote. Below that, in the right middle margin of the page, is a story illustrated by the statistic in bright red, 1 million. Caption explains, approximate number of French smokers who quit in the past year, according to a study by France's Public Health Agency. The decline appears to show that some recent anti-smoking measures, like price hikes, could be working. 1 million. Below that, in the lower right margin, is the recurring feature within a feature called Bad Week, Good Week. At Bad Week, Pompeo. Actor Ellen Pompeo, or Pompeo, of Grey's Anatomy, has purse stolen on Italian vacation. Under Good Week, Pompeii. Archaeologists make rare find at site of ancient volcanic eruption, unearthing the skeleton of a fleeing man. Pompeii. In the lower right corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from George Soros, investor, predicting, quote, another major financial crisis, unquote, while at the annual meeting of the European Council on Foreign Relations in Paris. And the major quote from investor George Soros, quote, the European Union is in an existential crisis. Everything that could go wrong has gone wrong, unquote. In the lower left corner of the page and running across the bottom is a story illustrated by the number 27. Caption explains, length in miles of a cat-proof fence recently completed in Central Australia. One of the largest of its kind in the world, is designed to protect endangered marsupials from predatory felines. 27 miles. This story is also illustrated by, running across the bottom of the page, a red and white and black color illustration, a line drawing of the fence with two cats on one side with their backs to the viewer. They are looking intently through the mesh at a couple of marsupials on the other side. Safe marsupials. In the middle left margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Lupe Valdez, Democratic nominee for Texas governor, after becoming the first Latina and first openly gay person nominated by a major party for that job. And the quotation from Lupe Valdez, quote, I'm getting darn good at uphill battles, unquote. In the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by the monetary amount, $18.83 million. Caption explains, amount paid by Spangler Candy Company, parenthetically maker of Dum Dum Lollipops and Circus Peanuts, for New England Confectionery Company, parenthetically Necco Wafers and Mary Jane's, at a federal bankruptcy auction. $18.83 million paid by Spangler Candy Company for New England Confectionery Company. That story is also illustrated by a line drawing of and including Dum Dum Lollipops, Circus Peanuts, Necco Wafers, and Mary Janes, all in red, white, and black. In the center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Niloufer Saba Azad, oncologist, after the American Cancer Society announced that patients should get screened for colorectal cancers starting at age 45. And the quotation from oncologist Niloufer Saba Azad, quote, "We can find a way, no matter how squeamish people are," unquote. In the center upper middle of the page is a quotation from, is a story rather, illustrated by a quotation in black and all caps from Jason Seaman, science teacher, reflecting on lunging at an armed student at Noblesville West Middle School in Noblesville, Indiana, on May 25th. The quotation from science teacher Jason Seaman, quote, "My actions on that day, in my mind, were the only acceptable actions," unquote. Caption goes on to say, Seaman was shot 3 times and a student was wounded. That is the For the Record page in its entirety. On the facing page is the beginning of the major section called The Brief. And the beginning of the brief is Opener. And the subsection is Nation. And the headline is Roseanne Barr Meets the New World by Carl Vick. When Roseanne returned to primetime television in March, it was only natural that the title character would be a Trump voter. The Republicans won the presidency on the hopes of the small towns and working class families the iconic ABC series brought to such warm and funny life through 9 seasons that ended the first time in 1997. A straight talker like Roseanne Conner almost prefigured the candidate who used his very first presidential debate to distinguish himself from ordinary politicians. Quote, "When they call, I give. And you know what? When I need something from them, 2 years later, 3 years later, I call them. They are there for me." Unquote. There was even talk that Roseanne's revival could bridge the chasms that opened in society in the 2 decades it was off the air. That was the stated hope of ABC and the cast. Quote, "I think the uniqueness is television has become splintered and fractured a little bit like our country has," unquote, said Michael Fishman, who played Roseanne's son DJ, in an interview with Entertainment Weekly. Quote, "There's something in the show for everybody," unquote. Not quite. When the end came this time on May 29th, it was because its namesake drove a spike into the body politic. A Trump supporter in real life, Barr posted a blatantly racist tweet likening Valerie Jarrett, an African-American senior advisor to former President Obama, to an ape. Within hours, ABC Entertainment President Channing Dungey delivered the network's verdict in a single, stinging line. Quote, "Roseanne's Twitter statement is abhorrent, repugnant, and inconsistent with our values, and we have decided to cancel her show." Unquote. That Trump's supporters include racists is hardly news. His candidacy was embraced by fringe elements ranging from former Ku Klux Klan Grand Wizard David Duke to the white supremacists who call themselves, quote, alt-right, unquote. Before running, Trump prepared the ground by championing the birther issue, speciously questioning Obama's American birth was widely understood as a dog whistle intended to undermine the legitimacy of the country's first African-American president. For those who understand Trump's upset election as a reaction to Obama's presidency, racism is part of the explanation. Among the studies detecting racial bias in Trump's base was a pre-election Reuters poll that found Trump supporters more likely than supporters of other candidates to describe blacks as, quote, violent, unquote, or, quote, lazy, unquote. Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences published a study in April crediting Trump's victory not to pocketbook concerns, the sort Barr cited in interviews, but rather to, quote, issues that threaten white Americans' sense of dominant group status, unquote. None of which means any given Trump supporter is racist or associates any previous greatness of America with the ignoble elements that nostalgia glosses over. But Barr sure filled the bill. Perhaps in the 1990s, her provocations could be read as ferocious ownership of a persona. But by the time ABC greenlighted the show last year, Barr's Twitter feed was a minefield of crank theories and overt racism. In a 2013 post she later deleted, Barr called Obama, National Security Advisor Susan Rice, quote, a man with big swinging ape, unrepeatable, unquote. A Hillary Clinton aide was, quote, a filthy Nazi whore, unquote. The revival of Roseanne, however, was a massive hit, and ABC ordered a second season after the first episode. Trump claimed it as a victory. Quote, I called her yesterday. Look at her ratings, unquote, the president crowed at an Ohio rally after the premiere. Quote, over 18 million people, and it was about us, unquote. But if social media lets everyone sound off, it also makes it much easier to circle the wagons in response. Barr posted her Jarrett slur the same day that Starbucks closed its U.S. stores for mandatory racial bias training. In the 21 years between seasons 9 and 10, major corporations emerged as enforcers of inclusion, punishing states for excluding transgender teens from public toilets or failing to support same-sex marriages. It's not only fear of boycotts driving the progressive stands, it's also the imperative of recruiting. Highly skilled creative employees can choose where they work. How much more attractive an employer is Sanofi? I'll repeat that beginning for clarity. How much more attractive an employer is Sanofi after answering Barr's post blaming Ambien for her rants with a post of its own? Quote, racism is not a known side effect of any Sanofi medication, unquote. Sanofi, the pronunciation may be Sanofi. ABC was on track to pocket perhaps $60 million next year off the revival, but at what cost? The network now competes not with two main rival networks, but a dozen streaming services for the writers and showrunners who can put together a series that stands apart the way Roseanne did, especially the first time around. But by the evening of May 29th, the revival was utterly and completely banished from every platform. YouTube, ABC Go, The Works. On PlayStation View, one of the ways to watch live TV in our splintered new world, the only evidence that remained was a vestigial listing on the digitized primetime grid for 8 p.m. ET. Quote, Season 10 Episode 3, Roseanne Gets the Chair, unquote. Entire article by Carl Vick. On the facing page, the subsection is The Bulletin, and the headline is The Right-Wing Newcomer Poised to Take Power in Colombia by Sierra Nugent. Nugent writes, Iván Duque is on track to succeed Juan Manuel Santos as president of Colombia after winning national elections on May 27th. But with 39% of the vote, the right-wing senator did not secure a large enough majority to avoid a runoff battle on June 17th with Gustavo Petro, a leftist former guerrilla who won 25%. Now Colombia faces a stark choice between hard left and hard right. Nugent now lists three items to illustrate. First item, fresh face. Just 41, the former lawyer has spent much of his adult life in the U.S., studying at Georgetown University and working at the Inter-American Development Bank in Washington, until former President Alvaro Uribe asked him to return to run for senator in 2014. With just one term under his belt, Duque is seen as inexperienced, but also free from the corruption allegations that dog Colombia's political elite. He's been nicknamed the Colombian Macron by Spanish-language media for his perceived similarity to the upstart president of France. Second item, deal breaker. Duque gained notoriety for fierce attacks on Colombia's 2016 peace agreement with Marxist guerrillas, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. Parenthetically, FARCE, F-A-R-C. The deal ended 52 years of civil war, which left 220,000 dead and displaced up to 7 million. But many felt it was too lenient on the militant group. Duque wants to scrap key parts of the agreement, including a partial amnesty for crimes committed by the FARCE, F-A-R-C. Final item, left behind. Analysts are not ruling out a second-round victory for Petro, whose railing against wealth inequality won him more votes than any other left-wing candidate in Colombian history. But Duque's market-friendly stance and promises to cut corporate taxes appeal to those in the center, worried by the country's sluggish economic growth. And with the economic crisis in neighboring Venezuela, having sent more than a million migrants pouring into Colombia in search of jobs and food, the country is widely expected to follow Argentina and Brazil in a Latin American rejection of the populist left. Entire item written by Ciara Nugent. Also on this page, in the sidebar, is the recurring feature News Ticker. It lists three items stacked top to bottom. Top item, EU proposes plastic ban to save the seas. The European Union proposed a ban on several single-use plastic items, including straws, cotton swabs, and drink stirrers, to help protect marine life and stop trash from spoiling beaches. The May 28th proposal must be approved by all EU member states before it is put into action. Second item, study finds Hurricane Maria killed 4,600. A new study published May 29th estimates that Hurricane Maria killed at least 4,645 people in Puerto Rico last year, 70 times the official toll of 64. Researchers surveyed 3,300 households to calculate a death rate that suggested Maria was the deadliest natural disaster to hit the U.S. in a century. bottom item. Malian hero promised French citizenship. A migrant from Mali was offered French citizenship and a job as a firefighter by President Emmanuel Macron after he scaled an apartment building to save a four-year-old dangling from a balcony on May 26th. When video of the feat went viral, Mamadou Gassama, 22, was nicknamed Spider-Man. Moving ahead, we now come to the weekly feature called Milestones. Under Died, Philip Roth, literary witness to interior life. Observance by Jesse Eisenberg. Time notes, Eisenberg is an actor and a playwright and the author of the story collection Bream Gives Me Hiccups and Other Stories. Jesse Eisenberg, writing about Philip Roth, says, it's probably for the best that Philip Roth made you forget how hard he worked. Although he produced an astonishing canon chronicling life in 20th century America, Roth, who died on May 22nd at 85, wrote in such a personal way that it gave the false impression of effortlessness. He made the extreme relatable, the tragic funny, and the foreign familiar. Even his alternative history, The Plot Against America, reads like an intimate coming of age. However, a passage in Patrimony, Roth's 1991 nonfiction account of his dying father, reveals his extraordinary work ethic. When Roth sneaks into his father's bathroom, stalling before giving his father the grim news of a brain tumor, he takes stock of the shelf above the toilet. He carefully notes his father's medications. He lists the, quote, Polident, Vaseline, Escriptin, his boxes of tissues, Q-tips, and absorbent cotton, unquote. He describes a pale blue porcelain shaving mug with its inscription, date, and floral pattern. Roth wants us to see a nervous son pacing the bathroom tiles, but it's impossible not to also see a writer scribbling notes. Patrimony is a portrait of a son confronting his father's death, but to me, it's an equally clear portrait of a writer hard at work, preserving for himself, as he had done for so many characters during his decades-long career, the moments of a life. Entire observance on Philip Roth by Jesse Eisenberg. That item is also accompanied by a black-and-white photograph. The caption of the photograph says, novels like Portnoy's Complaint established Roth, pictured in 1990, as an intimate portraitist of Jewish American experience. In the photograph, Roth is in an armchair, about halfway visible, and he's looking up at the photographer. Also on Milestones, Under Pardoned, Jack Johnson, boxing champ. Observance by Sean Gregory. Jack Johnson, who in 1908 became the first African-American boxer to win the heavyweight championship of the world, flaunted his defiance of bigotry. Quote, I am not a slave, unquote, Johnson said in 1912. Quote, I have the right to choose who my mate shall be without the dictation of any man, unquote. The U.S. government saw it differently. In 1913, after crossing state lines with a white woman, he was convicted under the anti-trafficking law known as the White Slave Traffic Act. A prosecutor mentioned Johnson's, quote, misfortune to be the foremost example of the evil in permitting the intermarriage of whites and blacks, unquote. He ended up serving a 10-month prison term. On May 24th, more than 70 years after Johnson's death, President Trump pardoned him. Senator John McCain, Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy, and many boxing luminaries had long supported clemency for Johnson. Former champ Lennox Lewis and Rocky creator Sylvester Stallone joined Trump at the Oval Office signing ceremony. Still, Johnson is a flawed icon, and evidence that he was violent toward women cannot be struck from his record. But the president's correction of this century-old racial injustice felt long overdue. Observance by Sean Gregory on Jack Johnson's pardon. Under died, Alan Dean, the fourth person to walk on the moon on May 26th at 86. After his NASA career, Bean became a painter chronicling the moon landings in his art. Under repealed, Ireland's constitutional amendment banning abortion by voters in a May 25th referendum. The landslide result was seen as a sharp rebuke to the Catholic Church. Under resigned, Missouri Governor Eric Greitens on May 29th, amid investigations over alleged sexual misconduct and data tampering. He denied criminal wrongdoing, but said his resignation would take effect June 1st. Under planned, the slaughter of some 150,000 cows in New Zealand in an attempt to eliminate a disease-causing bacterium. If the plan works, it will be the first time an infected country eliminates the pathogen. Under staged, the death of Russian journalist Arkady Babchenko, a critic of Moscow, who was reported to have been shot on May 29th, but reappeared on May 30th. Ukrainian officials said the fake death was meant to catch real killers. Under retired, race car driver Danica Patrick, 36, the only woman to lead in the Indy 500 and the Daytona 500, and the first to win an IndyCar race, after her final race on May 27th. Retired May 27th, Danica Patrick, 36. On the facing page is another edition of News Ticker, again stacking three news items top to bottom. Top item, NFL announces protest ban. The National Football League's team owners passed a policy May 23rd, imposing fines on teams whose players do not stand during the national anthem. Players can opt to stay in the locker room during the pregame ceremony. The players' union criticized the new rule and said it had not been consulted on the change. Middle item. Search for MH370 ends after 4 years. The search for the missing Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 has officially been brought to an end, even though the plane has not been found. The Boeing 777 disappeared over the South Indian Ocean on March 8, 2014, with 239 people on board, and repeated searches have failed to locate it. Final item, ruling. Trump can't block Twitter users. President Donald Trump violated the First Amendment when he or an aide blocked seven Twitter users because they disagreed with his views, a federal judge in New York ruled on May 23rd. The judge said, quote, no government official, including the president, is above the law, unquote. Also on this page, under the general heading postage, the headline is Special Delivery. the U.S. Postal Service is introducing scratch-and-sniff forever stamps with images of ice pops in June. Here, other unusual stamps from around the world, compiled by Abigail Abrams. Abrams lists three items left to right. First item on the far left, cork stamp. In Portugal, the world's largest cork producer issued the world's first stamp made entirely from cork in 2007 to honor the country's famed industry. The 230,000 stamps held a value of €1 each. Cork stamp. Middle item, chocolate stamp. In 2013, Belgium issued stamps that smelled, looked, and tasted chocolatey. A team of experts from Belgium, Germany, the Netherlands, and Switzerland created the delicious stamps. 2013. Final item on the far right, animated stamp. Canada Post issued a series of stamps in 2009 that seemed to move. They used technology called motion stamp to replay famous hockey goals in honor of the 100th anniversary of the Montreal Canadiens. Animated stamp. Moving forward, we are now at a different section. This one is the major section called The View. The subsection is Politics. The headline is The Deterrence Debate by James Stavridis. Time explains, Stavridis was the 16th Supreme Allied Commander at NATO and is Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. James Stavridis writes, President Trump and Kim Jong-un's courtship has been nothing if not fickle. And so, as the summit over North Korea's nuclear weapons veers from on again to off again, the world should consider the thinking of three distinguished U.S. military officers, two of whom just took pivotal posts in these turbulent times. And on the second page of the article, there is a color photograph collection of these three individuals, and the caption says, from left, Admiral Phil Davidson, Admiral Harry Harris, and General James Mattis. James Stavridis goes on to say, I know each of them very well from our decades of service and my time in the Pacific Fleet and as NATO Supreme Commander. General James Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, Admiral Harry Harris, who was officially nominated for U.S. Ambassador to South Korea the day before Trump withdrew from the summit with Kim, and Admiral Phil Davidson, Harris's new successor as commander of the vast U.S. Pacific Command. Together, they own the problem of determining how to return the U.S. to full-bore deterrence and giving the president new options for military strikes if the negotiations fail. What will their counsel be to the mercurial president? Let's start with Mattis. The decision about what actions the U.S. should take will likely play out in a three-way conversation among him, National Security Advisor John Bolton, and the President. Mattis is a thoughtful strategist with a deep sense of history, essentially the opposite of Trump. The President will continue to largely shoot from the hip. He'll ignore both the briefings and intelligence presented to him and will remain inclined to swing for the fences, if not in a summit, then in some kind of preemptive strike. Mattis will face the challenge of counseling patience while offering options for sanctions again. Cyber, intelligence, and missile defense, perhaps a naval blockade, and even both limited and massive strikes. Harris, a Japanese-American, will be parachuting into high drama. South Korean President Moon Jae-in, who had invested excessively in relationship building with Kim, will be anxious to heal the wounds inflicted by Trump's calling off the talks. Harris understands why. He knows the Korean War plans better than anyone and grasps exactly how devastating a war on the Korean Peninsula would be. He and his wife, Bruni, will also be located at Ground Zero. The newest member of the senior decision-making group is Admiral Phil Davidson, who is responsible for the entire military structure in the Pacific and a headquarters in Pearl Harbor. He arrived from a strictly Navy job in command of the overall U.S. fleet. However, he is a creative thinker with deep intellectual capability. He was hand-selected when he was a one-star to build a new diplomatic operational structure for Afghanistan and Pakistan, an unusual assignment for a Navy admiral, and one so complex it would have led many to quit. Davidson is close to Harris. Both admirals will be very skeptical of jumping into a war with North Korea, or even a limited strike. Parenthetically, the so-called bloody nose option. They will support Mattis's caution. While each of these senior leaders will be part of the ultimate conversation in the Situation Room, the command relationships are complicated. Harris technically reports directly to the president, but in reality communicates through Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Parenthetically, another key player who will likely take a moderate position. Davidson technically reports directly to the Secretary of Defense, but in reality coordinates and communicates largely through the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In the end, though, all of the caution from the military will go through Bolton, who reports only to the president. This will create tension. It is Bolton's job to present these views to Trump with honesty. But it is Bolton's nature to inject his strong and decisive personality into the debate, and he is unlikely to come down on the side of the angels in finding a diplomatic solution. Everything we know about Bolton would tell us that he will pursue the hard power answer. He lives in a zero-sum world in which danger lurks in every dimension. This causes him to overcompensate on the side of military force. Parenthetically, there are times when that makes sense. This is not one. Because of this organizational structure paired with this personal tendency, the chance of combat ultimately rises, despite these officers' likely counsel against it. Hopefully, America can find its way toward a diplomatic course, nonetheless. But these officers will need to help develop a nuanced negotiating stance in order to land this crisis without a fight. Entire article by James Stavridis. Sharing this page is the sidebar feature called Reading List. Time explains highlights from stories on time.com/ideas, and it lists three items stacked top to bottom. Top item, how it feels to protect the world's most vulnerable people. UN peacekeepers, known as Blue Helmets, shared what it's like to work on the ground in Congo via a virtual reality experience. As UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres explains in an introduction, the personnel are regularly targeted for killing. Metal item. Writing a sermon for the royal wedding. Bishop Michael Curry describes how he wrote his address and why he ventured off script. Quote, "There is enormous power, both motivational and transformational power, in love," unquote. He says, quote, "I picked up that cue and took that to the next step," unquote. Two different responses to gun deaths. Australia and the U.S. saw mass shootings a mere week apart. The different reactions showed that in Australia, where firearms are heavily regulated, quote, "Teasing out the reasons why a person might use a gun to kill are a little easier," unquote, writes Times' Belinda Luscombe. On the Facing page is a sidebar feature under the heading Education. The headline is What Grads Need to Hear by Melinda Gates. Times says Gates is a co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Melinda Gates writes, "This spring is a special one for our family. My daughter will graduate from college just days after my son graduates from high school. Even when I'm not playing the role of proud mom, I tend to be a fan of commencement season. I like hearing from America's thinkers, doers, and builders about their hopes for the next generation. But this year, I'm looking for something more. I want to know what these speakers plan to do to ensure that the future we'll share has a place in it for every graduate. It's no secret that the modern American workplace works better for some people than others. There are fewer female leaders of Fortune 500 companies than there are ones named James. And African American and Hispanic women hold less than 5% of jobs in tech. I hope that this year's commencement speakers will offer concrete plans for changing that. From paid family leave to mentorship programs to recruiting more diverse talent pools, there are many steps employers can take to remove the barriers that threaten graduates' dreams. Any commencement speaker can encourage young people to live up to their potential. But our graduates deserve more than encouragement. They deserve action." Entire item by Melinda Gates. Still in the View, we are now at a feature called First Person. And the headline says, What My Father, RFK, Means Today by Carrie Kennedy. Time notes, Kennedy is the president of the nonprofit Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights and author of the new book, Robert F. Kennedy, Ripples of Hope, from which this essay is adapted. Carrie Kennedy writes, Think of John F. Kennedy, Lyndon B. Johnson, or Richard Nixon. Each, in his own way, is firmly set in a certain era of American history. Yet, as vibrant as they were at the peak of their power and influence, none of these men could easily slip into the contemporary political world. Their leadership was unique to their time and place. That does not ring true for my father, Robert F. Kennedy, who was killed 50 years ago. His appearance is ever modern. The shaggy hair, the skinny tie, the suit jacket off, the shirt sleeves rolled. Beyond appearances, what is striking about RFK are the themes he returned to again and again, themes that still energize the debate and resonate in our own time. Think of the headlines and over the past few years, and it is easy to hear Robert Kennedy's voice and imagine him speaking out in our country on the madness of gun violence, the shame of police brutality, the need for compassion in welcoming immigrants and refugees, the urgent need to defy the call to war, and, where war has broken out, the moral necessity of seeking peace. One imagines hymns urging us to focus not only on stopping terrorism, but also on understanding addressing its root causes. He would encourage us to focus on the destructive force of hate, the disillusionment of young people, the inherent injustice of a criminal justice system that discriminates based on race and class, and sends thousands to jail simply because they are too poor to make bail, the new Jim Crow. And it's easy to think of RFK reminding us of the duty to address the struggles of those who are not in the headlines, the most vulnerable among us, farm workers, small farmers, factory workers, people who have seen the jobs that once supported them replaced by cheap labor or technology. He would also remember our duty to Native Americans and those suffering in the hollows of Appalachia, on the Mississippi Delta, and in the most destitute slums of our great cities. In the 1950s, he spent much of his time on the Senate Committee on Investigations, fighting the excesses of its chair, Joe McCarthy, and his chief counsel, Roy Cohn, two figures who echo in the news today. He later called Cohn's resignation and led to the end of McCarthy's reign of terror. Asked a decade later by Peter Maas how he could have worked for McCarthy, Kennedy responded, quote, "Well, at the time, I thought there was a serious internal security threat to the United States, and Joe McCarthy seemed to be the only one doing anything about it. I was wrong," unquote. But to leave it at stopping the bullet, would not do him justice. On that terrible night when he told a crowd in downtown Indianapolis that Martin Luther King Jr. had been murdered, he included in his remarks a quote from Aeschylus, quote, "To tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of the world," unquote. Indeed, my father focused much of his life taming the savageness, and he made gentle the life of the world. There was no quality my father admired more than courage, save, perhaps, love. I remember after dinner one night, he picked up the battered poetry book that was always somewhere by his side, and read aloud Tennyson's poem, "The Charge of the Light Brigade." We listened aghast to the story of a group of soldiers whose commanding officer orders them to ride into an ambush, knowing they will be slaughtered. Yet they still obey the command. My father then explained that he and my mother were going on a trip and challenged us to a contest to see who could best memorize the poem while they were away. I did not win the contest. My sister Courtney did. But one stanza still remains with me. Quote, "There's not to reason why. There's but to do and die. Into the valley of death rode the 600. Unquote. Why would a father ask his ever-expanding brood of what became 11 children to memorize a poem about war and slaughter? I think there were three reasons. He wanted to share with us his love of literature. He wanted us to embrace challenges that appear daunting. But most of all, he believed it was imperative for us to question authority and to learn how those who fail that lesson do so at their own peril. Now, coming upon 50 years after Robert F. Kennedy's last campaign, those are among the lessons I think he would have liked to impart to all Americans. we face daunting challenges, both nationally and globally. But we must rise to those tasks armed with courage, faith, love, and an abiding commitment to justice, yet girded with a healthy sense of skepticism. Entire article on RFK, adapted from a book by Kerry Kennedy. That book, again, is Robert F. Kennedy, Ripples of Hope, by Kerry Kennedy. Kerry is spelled K-E-R-R-Y. Moving forward in the view, we now come to the subsection Society, where the headline is, Weinstein's Arrest is Just the Opening Scene, by Eliana Dochterman. On May 25th, nearly 8 months after more than 70 women accused him of sexual harassment and assault, Harvey Weinstein entered New York's First Precinct, just a few blocks from his old Tribeca office, and turned himself in. The scene was carefully curated, like something out of one of the former producer's Oscar-winning films. Weinstein wore a baby blue sweater, a soothing color that evokes the innocence of childhood. He carried books about art and filmmaking to remind viewers he's an artist first. Later in court, he pleaded not guilty to raping one woman and forcing another to perform oral sex. The police, too, set up an important shot of their own, the perp walk. Pointedly, a female detective led cuffed Weinstein out of the precinct. The day offered just a preview of the spectacle that will play out on a national stage over the next several months. Both sides know that the Weinstein trial is the first installment of a series of dramas that will feature other accused men. What we've watched up until this point has been its own genre, the revenge fantasy. The people who came forward in October with allegations against Weinstein, including actors Ashley Judd, Gwyneth Paltrow, and Lupita Nyong'o, kick-started the Me Too movement. Women from all walks of life took to social media to expose the men they said had abused them. The movement had, and continues to have, real potency. In May, Visa suspended an ad campaign with Morgan Freeman, and Missouri Governor Eric Greitens was pressured to resign after each of them faced allegations of sexual misconduct. Whether their disgrace will be permanent is unclear. Men such as Kevin Spacey and Bill O'Reilly are still banished from film and media, and have decamped to their mansions. Parenthetically, in Weinstein's case, it was an Arizona rehab center that offers meditation and equine therapy. Now Weinstein's story could end in prison rather than at a retreat, and the rest of us will get to witness something often frustrating, but perhaps more satisfying, a courtroom drama. The justice system has been slow to act on Me Too claims, and Weinstein is the first major celebrity arrested since the wave began. Parenthetically, he's also still under investigation in London and Los Angeles. This is where the strength of the social media movement will be put to the test. Justice is swift on Twitter, but the American legal system is notoriously slow. In April, 3 years and two jury trials after New York Magazine featured Bill Cosby's many accusers on their cover, the actor was convicted of sexual assault. His appeal could take years. What lost Weinstein his job, his company, and his reputation was the sheer number of women who spoke out in articles, in op-eds, and on Twitter. it's not certain how many of those women will be allowed to testify during his trial to establish a pattern of bad behavior. Those types of testimonies proved powerful at the sentencing hearings for both Cosby and Team USA gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar. The last thing Weinstein's attorneys want is to have woman after woman take the stand to recount Weinstein's alleged misconduct. As Ashley Judd recently wrote for Time, Weinstein's arrest shouldn't have been a surprise. Quote, a sexual predator being legally accountable for criminal behavior is and should be normal, routine, and not particularly newsworthy. Unquote. And yet, the arrest did signal a shift in the Me Too movement. Many men accused of criminal behavior lost their careers, but they didn't risk losing their freedom. Now the justice system is stepping in. Weinstein maintains that his sexual acts were consensual, and as his lawyer put it on the day of the arrest, quote, Mr. Weinstein did not invent the casting couch in Hollywood, unquote. It's true that he was not the only one whose unethical and allegedly criminal behavior was an open secret. Spacey is currently under investigation for sexual misconduct, as are celebrity chef Mario Batali and actor Ed Westwick. It's clear now that Me Too was the prelude, a catalyst for a new story. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Randall Rickman, reading for Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. That's TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. This is your reader, Randall Rickman, thanking you again. So long until next time, please join us for Time.